Hello, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Coming up, right after the news, it's Philosophy Talk.
This week, we're taking you out to the old ball game.
Are we turning Philosophy Talk into a sports talk show, John? What are we going to do, field calls about the Mariners and who they should start tomorrow, or whether Alou should bat Bonds third or fourth?
I was thinking more along the lines of what we can learn from our passion for baseball. Is our passion for baseball something irrational? Are there other things more intrinsically important? How does baseball differ from family or country or other things we have loyalty to?
Like your favorite radio program, Philosophy Talk, returns with a discussion of the philosophy of baseball after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
Our program originates from the studios of KALW Information Radio 91.7, San Francisco's oldest FM station.
But today, we'd like you to imagine yourself seated with us in a circle on the carpet-like lawn of Sunken Diamond, home of the Stanford Cardinal baseball team.
It's a wonderful place to watch a ball game and a perfect setting for a discussion on baseball and philosophy.
You know, but John, some people think that watching baseball, I mean, they're wrong, but they think this, it's like watching paint dry. And those people must think that talking about baseball is even more deadly, like talking about paint drying.
Well, Ken, that raises the question of why baseball? It's not one of your standard philosophical topics that you hit on intro to philosophy, or see a course in at the big philosophy departments. But we want to illustrate the point that anything that's fun to talk about and fun to think about is fun to talk and think about philosophically. Now, that probably doesn't include watching paint dry.
Yeah,
but
right.
Opera, baseball, Even other sports like football could conceivably be interesting to talk and think about philosophically. But secondly, Ken, I do think that philosophy themes, traditional philosophy themes, and baseball do meet somewhere. There are some relevant things to be learned from baseball.
Yeah, like there's this question about loyalty, you know. I mean, we're loyal to all sorts of things, country, family, you know, your favorite radio program. And then we're deeply loyal to baseball teams. And this question is that kind of loyalty irrational? Does it make any sense? And then it's also related to that is what exactly are you loyal to when you're loyal to a baseball team since, you know, the players keep coming and going?
Well, some people think that loyalty to a baseball team or some other sports entity like that has to be a bit of a pretense, a facade. Yeah. They're not intrinsically important things, and why should you be loyal to them? And the opposition is, say, to your city or your country or your family. Others say, well, you know, nothing's really that intrinsically important. It's important because we care about. If we care about baseball, good for baseball.
Right. You know, money is just paper, right? You know, it's not intrinsically worth anything, but we care about it deeply. So things that don't have any intrinsic worth can still be objects of deep affection and you know.
But what's the contrast? You think there are things of intrinsic worth?
Well, I think families are of intrinsic worth. I'm a little less certain about nations, and we care a lot about those things, you know.
Some other questions. You mentioned the one about identity. What is it we're loyal to? I mean, the San Francisco Giants are my favorite team since I've been an adult, but Am I loyal to the same thing that used to be in the Polo Grounds in New York City? Different players, different owner, different place to play, different city.
Yeah.
Even the uniforms are a different color. So what is it I'm loyal to?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was and have been all my life loyal to the Cleveland Indians. Now, you could ask, now, what kind of loyalty is that? But you know what? There are lots of philosophers love to talk about baseball, and Amy Standen, our roving philosophical reporter, tracked down another one, not just you and me and our upcoming guest, John. She files this report.
I just think it's a great game with a lot of history, and I like watching it, and I like studying it.
Ted Cohen is a philosopher at the University of Chicago and a baseball fan.
For somebody like me, baseball is a particularly good and fruitful thing to think about and to just kind of wonder about, and then if you want to dignify it with these words, to philosophize about, is that baseball is the most complicated game played by large numbers of people. And the test of it is this. No chance for a double play. Imagine somebody who doesn't know anything at all about this game, and he comes and watches people play it. But he doesn't get to read the rule book. He doesn't get to ask anybody any questions. Now the question is, how soon, if at all, will he figure out what the rules of this game actually are?
We've got a real Pier 6 brawl going right at home plate.
And my very strongly held conviction is that it'll take longer with baseball than with any other sport. And in fact, he may never figure out what's going on.
It's not just what you see on the field. Baseball has one of the most elaborate rule books in sports. And the book keeps changing, getting longer, more complicated.
You're never going to get it done. There will always be something will come up that you didn't think about, something that you hadn't imagined, and then the rules won't cover it, or it won't be clear how the rules do cover it, and there will have to be another decision made. It's pretty plain that almost everybody playing the game doesn't know all of the rules, and yet the game works anyway.
Debating the rules of baseball is one of the pleasures of the game. So is record keeping. Baseball history is crammed with records. Perfect games, no hitters, on-base percentages, and, of course, this one.
By Downing, swinging. There's a drive into left center field. That ball is going to be out of here. It's gone. It's 7-15. There's a new home run champion of all time, and it's Henry Aaron.
This is the record that San Francisco slugger Barry Bonds, who knocked his godfather Willie Mays out of the number three spot, aims to break. Naturally, even that's open to debate.
He's still behind Babe Ruth as well as behind Hank Aaron. Suppose that eventually he hits more home runs than Babe Ruth and moves into second place. There will be people saying, well, yeah, he's got more home runs than Babe Ruth, but Babe Ruth didn't play as long as Barry Bonds. Barry Bonds has been hitting 30, 40, 50 home runs every year for a certain number of years. Babe Ruth didn't play that many years. Well, let's have a look at how frequently people hit home runs. Is it every 5 times at bat, every 20 times at bat?
On swings, high drive, there it goes, number 660, headed for the cove, that one is wet! Barry Bonds has done it!
This is one of the things that makes the world go round, is the possibility of these kind of endless conversations and arguments. It's one of the things that sports fans do all the time. They criticize the way the team played, they say that the manager should have put in a substitute, they say that the batter should have been told to try to bunt the ball.
And really, philosophy is a fancy word for doing just that, arguing endlessly over unanswerable questions for fun and maybe tenure.
We like these endless conversations in which we argue, but we know that in principle, there's no way to really settle this permanently. And somehow we just enjoy that. Was Ulysses S. Grant a better general than Robert E. Lee? People will argue about this till the end of time, even though you know that in the end, it won't be settled. And I think that's terrific.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Thanks, Amy, for that report. And thanks to KNBR Radio and the San Francisco Giants for the play-by-play of Barry Bonds' historic home run. You know, Ken, Ted's right about the rules of baseball. I had a young friend from Tajikistan, a good athlete. And I was explaining to him as we watched one of my granddaughter's softball games the other day just how baseball works. And I was amazed at how complicated it got. I mean, like, 3 strikes and you're out. Oh, okay. Fouls count as strikes. Oh, okay. Except that if a foul is caught, you're out. Oh, okay. Unless it's a foul tip, then you're not out. Oh, okay. Except for the 3rd strike. Oh. But then a foul isn't a strike on the 3rd strike, unless it's a foul tip and it is caught, and then you're out. Oh, well, I get it.
You're right.
Oh, by the way, if it's a 3rd strike and you swing and they drop the ball, then you can run to first. As a matter of fact, in girls softball, that's the main way you get to first.
Yeah, right.
At this point, he threw up his hands in despair.
Yeah, well, as well he might have. You're right. The rules are complicated. But we don't need to despair this week because we've got our designated hitter and relief pitcher all in one joining us. That's Alan Wood, our friend and colleague from Stanford University. Alan's a very prolific philosopher. He's written books about Hegel, Marx, Kant, those abstract German idealists that, you know, only he understands, really. But when he likes to get concrete, he likes to think about baseball. And he's one of the he's a huge fan of the game. And he's an unending source of wisdom and trivia about the game. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alan.
Yeah, thanks, Kent.
Hi, Alan. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. I thought Kant to Hegel to Marx. I thought that was a double play combination for the Cubs. Have I got that wrong?
It was Tinker to Evers to Chance.
Oh, yeah. Something like that, I knew. Okay, Alan. Here's a kind of an easy pitch for you to knock out of the park. Why do humans care about baseball?
Ah, that's not an easy one. I think, though, that the reason why a lot of baseball fans care about it is that it's a kind of drama. It's an unscripted drama. And it's more dramatic in many ways than some scripted dramas. There are a number of things about the game that make it especially dramatic. One distinctive feature of baseball is that the defense has the advantage. They hold the field. They own the ball. Another important...
Well, Alan, you know, is that unique to baseball? I guess cricket.
Pretty much, cricket. Yeah, yeah. Of course, cricket is historically has an affinity to baseball, and many of the things you say about baseball will also be true of cricket.
Yeah, usually the offense has the ball, and the defense is trying to seize the ball from the offense.
Right.
But in baseball, it's the reverse, right?
That's right. And the one sign is that not only the defense has the ball, but the defense has the advantage. Trying to get on base, trying to get around the bases is a challenge. And they say that the greatest success that an offensive ball player can have is to be successful 3/10 of the time.
Yeah. But right? Tell me, you said that makes it more dramatic. I don't quite have the sense of... I have a sense so far of difficulty, but to illustrate why baseball is more dramatic.
Well, there are other features that make it dramatic. One is the relationship between the fact that it's a team sport and the fact that every play focuses successively on individuals. So that there's a kind of hero. There's no chorus like a Greek tragedy, but there's a team, and there is a hero, sometimes a tragic hero,
or
sometimes...
A goat.
Right, a glorious hero,
or a goat,
or a goat. Yeah. That's right,
Alan. My one of my sports writer heroes, Leonard Coppett, who said once, I think in his Thinking Man's Guide to Baseball, that the fundamental fact about baseball is the fear that never goes away of the pitched ball. That's the core of the game. Mm. Do you agree with that?
Well, some guys have it and some guys don't. I mean, there are pitchers who have relied on that fear. And there are some who didn't. Ty Cobb is supposed to have said he got hits off of Walter Johnson by crowding the plate because he knew Walter Johnson was a nice man and wouldn't throw at him. And it was true.
Really?
Ty Cobb was not a nice man.
No, Ty Cobb probably has the distinction of being like the meanest cuss ever to play baseball.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, he has the highest batting average in baseball history, and he once said that about 40% of his batting average was mental. And that, of course, partly means his meanness and his determination and his willing to use every trick he could use.
Okay, you guys are both big baseball fans. That's pretty obvious. And you each have your teams. I know with Ken, it's the Cleveland Indians, a minor league team. I guess with you, it's the Seattle Mariners, another minor league team.
I myself am a minor league team who a couple of years ago tied the record for the most wins in a season.
All right. But now, is this loyalty? Isn't this a bit of a facade? Do you really take it seriously? I mean, come on, a baseball team. What's intrinsically important about a baseball team? Isn't just a pretense you do because you enjoy it?
Well, it's not just a pretense. It's something that you feel, but at the same time, you know that it's part of the drama. It's like being on the side of a hero in a play. You can sometimes feel very strongly for heroes in plays, for King Lear or Hamlet. And I think you have the same kind of real emotions about a dramatic performance, and all the more so because it isn't quite fake. There are real people who are engaging in real attempts to win.
That makes it sound kind of cool. I mean, because other loyalties can lead you to do very bad things. You know, they can lead you to march off to some insane war or discriminate, if you're loyal to your race, discriminate and enslave people of a different race. So actually, this pretend loyalty that gets your emotions going. Sounds like a really cool thing. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're talking baseball with Professor Alan Wood of Stanford University. Why not join our discussion? You can do so by calling us at 415-841-4134. Here's some questions for you to think about. Is our loyalty and devotion to baseball and other sports irrational or rational? Does the unique complexity of baseball add or subtract to its beauty? And I really do mean beauty. Does our adulation of baseball heroes, given all their foibles, make any sense at all?
We'd like you to step up to the plate. Give us a call, 415-841-4134, or go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment.
We'll be right back.
Sister Winona Carr with The Ball Game. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Joining us is Alan Wood, a prolific writer in German idealism and baseball, our colleague from Stanford University.
Our topic today is the philosophy of baseball. We want to know what you have to say. So run to the phone and hit these numbers, taking care to make no errors.
The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Is our loyalty and devotion to baseball and other sports irrational? Does the unique complexity of baseball add or subtract to its beauty from its beauty? Does our adulation of baseball heroes make any sense at all, given their great human foibles?
Alan, baseball fans like us and most Americans like to think that there is something about it that makes it superior to most other sports. But what is it? Are any of these things that you've mentioned really, I mean, this idea that the defense is controlled, does that make baseball a better metaphor for life than other sports? Or are we just chauvinists about our sports?
Well, we may be partly just chauvinists about it. I think that it is more dramatic than other sports, though it requires more careful attention, more studying of the game. Some of the sports that have become more popular in the second half of the 20th century, I think, are more popular because they give more instant gratification. Baseball, you have to watch more carefully and think more about to enjoy it.
There is this thought, you know, a baseball game in principle could go on forever. There's no clock in baseball. I mean, there's a number of outs and a number of innings, but an inning can last, well, as long as it takes the one team to make three outs against the other team. So, I mean, does it, you know, think that adds to the complexity, to the drama of baseball at all?
Well, one thought about it is that if you're at bat, the only way your team is going to lose is you have to go out. The other team can't run out the clock.
Right, right. So there's no four corners offense, as it were. Right.
Alan, what's the longest game ever played?
I think there was a 26-inning game back in the 50s. I'm sorry, I don't remember. I think it was between the Dodgers and the Cubs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we have a caller on the line, Heather in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Heather.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question or comment?
I was just going to say, I think the thing that I find most interesting in baseball is the relationship between the pitcher and the batter and the sort of drama between the two of them.
I agree with you, Heather. I think you're right. That's why I actually prefer the designated hitter rule, John, because there's more batters in the American League, and there's more contest between pitcher. In the National League, the hitter is mostly clueless. Well, so you pitch around the number eight hitter, right? You take the bat out of one. So you've really got seven effective hitters in the National League.
Ken, there's lots of games based on baseball that have certain advantages over baseball. A girls' softball league my granddaughters play in, all the batters get to come up, even if they're not playing in the field. You know, I don't deny that these lesser games have their interests, but the National League game, as we call baseball, still seems to me the best of all. But now, I just want to make one point, Alan, that baseball seems to have been lucky in that some of its features that were developed long before television really lend themselves to television. One is the fact that there's plenty of time for commercials. And the other is that the cameraman can focus on these two antagonists, the pitcher and the batter, and you can see them in a way that you really can't, even at the field.
That's right. It's only in recent years, when the camera work has become superior, that you can appreciate a lot of the drama of the game, because you can try to second guess the batter and the pitcher. The pitcher's always trying to figure out where the batter will think the ball is, and he's trying to put it somewhere else. And you can try to do this yourself. I think part of the enjoyment of the game is seeing a pitcher who's really good at this, like Greg Maddux or Jamie Moyer. These are guys who win because they outguess the batter.
That's a beautiful thing. You can watching baseball on television with the right camera angles, you can watch a sinking fastball actually sink, and you can see that. The batter anticipates it being in this plane, and by the time it gets to the plate, it's at a plane below that. I mean, you can see that movement, and you can see the sequence of pitches that sets up that chain of. I think that's why baseball is an art object. Almost.
Yes,
I mean, I just love the thing.
Anything more exciting than a 3-2 count? A hitter has fouled it off endlessly, and you need to go to the bathroom. What a combination! What a combination of factors that make baseball the most exciting sport.
We've got lots of baseball fans in our audience. Rick in San Francisco's on the phone. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Rick.
Hi, nice to be on. I would hold it in that case.
You would hold it in that case. Huh? So, what's your question, Rick?
It's not a question so much as I wanted to talk a little bit about the foundation for remaining loyal to a team.
Okay, that's a good thing.
You know, when baseball first got going in this country, the reason they're called baseball clubs is they initially were actually clubs. They were clubs of men who would get together and play, and they would compete with people from around the region. And they started traveling farther, and then someone decided to start paying these people. And initially it was a matter of civic pride. You know, people would be loyal to their neighborhood's team, then their city's team when it became a city-based sport. And now today you've got people like especially Cubs fans, I know several of those,
yeah.
Who, you know, no matter where they go, in fact, they pass it generation to generation. I have a very good set of friends, a family, where, you know, the father is from Chicago, and he has passed on his love for the Cubs to his daughter who's grown up her entire life in California.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. So, Alan, what do you think about that? I mean, he says that loyalty is a kind of, well, it's kind of connected to a sense of place. You know?
Well, originally it was. In fact, originally when baseball turned professional and teams were able to buy up the services of people who weren't from the region where the club was from, some people thought that was a corruption of the game.
But, yeah. So, yeah. No longer. I've lived all over the country, and every place I've lived, I've still been deeply loyal to the Cleveland Indians through thick and thin. Does that make any sense, given, you know, that we're a mobile society and all?
Well,
I mean, it was kind of a...
It's not only you that changes, it's the Cleveland Indians. They're one of the few teams that hasn't moved from city to city, but the players aren't the same, the owner's probably not the same, the stadium's not the same, the uniforms have probably been debased in some way or another.
Their uniforms are debased. They've got that Chief Wahoo slogan on them.
Yeah,
right.
But so, I mean, does it make any sense? Is it rational, given the way we now live?
Our enjoyment of aesthetic objects in general is only partly rational. And I think that's probably true about baseball. I think it's a way of being connected to your hometown. It's my connection to Seattle that I'm a Mariners fan. It's your connection to Cleveland that you're an Indians fan.
Yeah, and John's connection to Lincoln, Nebraska.
Well, Lincoln had a minor league team. I hope it still does. They had different names, Lincoln Chiefs, Lincoln A's, at different times because different teams hired them to be the farm club, or sometimes they were just on their own. But I was loyal to players. Nellie Fox and Bobby Shantz played for Lincoln, so I became loyal to the A's and to the White Sox for that reason, then later Dick Hall. Dick Stewart played for the Pirates. I have a soft spot in my heart for all those teams. But is this loyalty less rational than our loyalties to cities, states, and countries? Or one could argue it's a better kind of loyalty because we know what it's based on and we don't fool ourselves, or at least some of us don't. What do you think about that, Alan?
Yeah, well, I think part of the loyalty that many baseball fans feel isn't necessarily loyalty to a region. The first major league team I became loyal to was the Brooklyn Dodgers. I didn't live in Brooklyn, but it was because of the way Brooklyn was regarded within New York. It was because of the history of the Dodgers. It was really because I thought they had been mistreated by fortune.
Yeah.
And they were a better team than that. And they were admirable because they had Jackie Robinson and Roy Campanella and Don Newcomb. And it was really the Bobby Thompson's home run defeating the Dodgers in 1951 that turned me into a Dodger fan.
Yeah.
Didn't turn me into a Giants fan. Turned me into a Dodgers fan.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Professor Alan Wood from Stanford University. We'd like you to join us. You can do so by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Carl in Alameda has done just that. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Carl.
Thank you. Actually, I'm a transplanted New Yorker who sold beer in the Yankee Stadium.
And still loyal to the evil empire, I suppose.
No, I'm not. I'm not loyal to them at all. The more I learned about their history, especially reading David Halberstam's book about 1964 and the difference between the Yankees and the Cardinals, I kind of identify much more with the Brooklyn Dodgers sentiment with than being... with the Yankees, who I, to me, rooting for the Yankees like rooting for Microsoft.
Oh, there you go. I'm with you there. So what's your question for us, Carl?
Actually, it was more of a comment when I spoke to your the person who took the calls. I was talking about coming to appreciate baseball more by watching my daughter and my daughter's softball teams. You know, go through the challenges of learning the game and even trying to coach a little, although I'm not a good baseball player. But I came to appreciate much more all of the subtle skills and the beautiful skills that professionals have by, you know, watching these girls trying to master softball.
Yeah, I think thanks for the call. I think there's something to that. I mean, baseball is, let's say, a really hard sport to master, and that even when you're successful, you mostly fail as a hitter, for example, right? And that's, you know, that's one of the problems with baseball, one of the reasons it's disappearing a little bit from our cities and suburbs, because soccer is very accessible. I mean, there's a high level of skill at the highest level, but it's very accessible. Well, what do you think about that?
Well, I think baseball looks superficially like it's easy to play, and people can imagine playing it. I played it when I was a kid. I was no good. I wasn't much of an athlete, but I did enjoy playing it, and you have the same sense that the actions that they're doing, you could do. You don't have to be a great big tall guy as in basketball. You don't have to be a 300-pounder like in football. It looks like something that anybody could do.
Well, it's getting less that way now, but baseball's mm-hmm. historically been a nice place for drunks and people totally out of shape with some really basic skill to shine. I think of Grover Cleveland Alexander and his great performance against the Yankees.
1926, absolutely.
And what did he do, Alan?
Well, the Yankees were leading three games to two, and he came back in the sixth game and won it. And he went out and celebrated the next night and came into the park with a big hangover. And then in the seventh inning, the bases were loaded and Tony Lazzari was up and there were two outs. And they brought him in from the bullpen, hangover and all, and he struck out Lazzari, and he got him out in the last two innings and was the hero of the series.
So do you remember, Alan, which pitches he threw to each of them?
No.
I want to ask you, two guys, what's the philosophical issue here? I mean, is it that in baseball we celebrate the achievements of drunks and ne'er-do-wells? I mean, and racist? I mean, Ty Cobb and all those people? I mean, let's ask this question. Why do we adore these guys, given that so many of them so many of the best of them are just, you know,
I mean,
smucks to use that.
The heroes we actually adore, like I in spite of my anti-Yankee feelings, love Mickey Mantle when he first came up, or Joe DiMaggio, but those presumably are constructions. Mm-hmm. They're not the real people. Does that matter? Is that interesting? Does it? Who gets into the Hall of Fame, the constructions or the real people?
Yeah.
Well, if it were the constructions, wouldn't Pete Rose be in the Hall of Fame right now?
If it were entirely the constructions, I think we have a lot of ambivalence about this. There's a certain amount of fantasy. That's why I think of it as sort of a drama. And there's the actor and there's the character. And in the story I just told about Grover Alexander, the actor Alexander, who had a hangover, was thereby cast for a certain role, and he played it beautifully. So, and if he hadn't been a drunk, he couldn't have. It wouldn't have the same meaning.
So we can't make up our minds. Right?
That's right.
So on the one hand, it's the mythical, the character in the drama that is focused on in the game. But on the other hand, these are real people with real lives, and somehow we think that matters to whether they're worthy of our adulation, whether they're worthy of the highest praise we can give to the. I mean, who's the worst character in the Hall of Fame?
Oh, well, it depends on. Ty Cobb was morally probably about the worst guy who ever played the game.
How about Cap Anson?
Cap Anson, he was more than anybody else responsible for the fact that after 1884 until 1947, there were no blacks allowed in Major League Baseball.
He was the guy who refused to play against teams that had black players.
He wouldn't play, and he had all the more power because he was the dominant player of his era.
You're telling me Jackie Robinson wasn't the first black to play in the major leagues?
No, it was Fleet Walker, a catcher for the Toledo Blue Stockings in 1884. Toledo was a major league team in those days.
Okay, Alan and Ken, here's something from the internet, a comment from the internet from Steve. The beauty, intricacy, and drama of baseball derive from its perfect balance of human ability and physics, or as Red Smith said, 90 feet between bases is the closest thing man has to perfection. Is that just hyperbole of the fan, or is there really some objective basis for this perfection that baseball fans claim?
Well, I think 90 feet turns out to be a very special distance. If you try to imagine what the game would be like if it was a little more than 90 feet or a little less, it would change the game greatly in either direction, and it wouldn't be as exciting.
Yeah. We have a caller in the line. That's Jim in Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jim.
Hi. Well, I agree with you guys on a lot of points on that, and I think baseball is a great equalizer. When I was a kid, we used to play baseball with a broomstick and Brad wrappers with rubber bands around them.
Oh,
so
yeah?
It was very inexpensive for us to play baseball, and it was before wiffle ball, and we had a great time.
I think also,
like you guys have talked about with race relations, Jackie Robinson really was a tremendous push in the civil rights movement with his breaking the color barrier in baseball in the 40s. But also the Negro teams, it was a great economic boost for the black communities when the Negro teams would play in, say, like Yankee Stadium and so forth. That was a real big economic boost for the black community. And right now you're seeing a lot of Latin players and a lot of Asian players that are coming over.
Yeah. So baseball has some good social effects. Takes on some things that you'd expect our educators and politicians to do in terms of making opportunities available to people. It's a great game. There's no doubt about it. But Ken from the internet asks, are sports ritualized forms of war? Have they evolved to sublimate warlike instincts? I would ask, is war just something that developed out of sports?
Well, would you let me ask you a question. Would you prefer a ritualized form of war in which the downside is, well, you lose a game or lots of people lose their lives? So if it is a ritualized form of war, that's pretty darn good. I mean, you know, if we could substitute the ritualized form for the real form, I think we'd be better off. I mean, what do you think, Alan?
Yeah, that's right. I think the kind of competition you get in sports generally is a sublimation of some of these things and a good and something that's good for us. Baseball is less warlike than some other sports. It's more subtle.
Yeah, you're not trying to do any harm, mostly. I mean, that fastball coming in on the inside could do some serious harm. But mostly you're not trying to do any harm to the other
player. Runner barreling into the catcher at home plate.
Are you guys trying to hint that we'd be better off if George W. had stayed in charge of the Texas Rangers?
Yeah, baby. Our guest today is Professor Alan Wood of Stanford University. Up next, the speedster on the Philosophy Talk 9. That's Ian Scholes. He runs down the life of A. Bartlett Giamatti. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Now it's time for the seventh inning stretch.
John Fogerty with his classic about wanting to get off the bench and into the game, Center Field, from the album of the same name. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry, and I'll tell you, I used to sit on the bench saying, no, not now, coach. Wait till the weaker pitcher gets in.
Yeah. And I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking philosophy and baseball.
A philosopher is literally someone who loves knowledge. In the history of the game of baseball, it's difficult to find a wiser man than the late Commissioner A. Bartlett Giamatti, unless it's our guest Alan Wood. Giamatti loved knowledge, and he loved the game of baseball. Hopefully you'll love this next piece by Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, born in 1938, A. Bartlett Giamatti was the son of an Italian scholar who collected translations of Dante's Divine Comedy. Giamatti grew up to become an enthusiastic and popular teacher of Renaissance literature at Yale University, eventually became Yale's president. Then, apparently impressed by his tough handling of the college's union, baseball owners asked him to be president of the National League. Giamatti worked to preserve baseball's traditions and to improve the ballparks to make them more pleasant for the fans. His tenure there was impressive enough that he was made Commissioner of Baseball in 1989. Why an egghead like Angelo Bartlett Giamatti? Because he valued precision. He valued rules. He was a skilled administrator, though he had no passion for it, but most of all because he was a lifelong baseball fan, bringing the same enthusiasm to the sport that he did to his scholarship. He claimed that Dante himself would have been a baseball fan. Quote, Dante would have approved of any sport whose first game in 1845 was played on something called the Elysian Fields in Hoboken, New Jersey, unquote. Elysium was the mythical heaven on earth where the virtuous dead feast, sing, and play games. The fact that the first baseball game was played in Elysian Fields delighted Giamatti, who had written a book called Take Time for Paradise, a meditation on American sports. Giamatti viewed a baseball game as an Elysian event, players and spectators gathering in a green park to celebrate their own community and the best of which humans are capable. The concept of heaven on earth was dear to Giamatti. His scholarly work, The Earthly Paradise and the Renaissance Epic, explored this symbol, Eden and Milton, Dante's Earthly Paradise, Elysium, Earthly Heavens, gardens lost to us but regained through virtue. Giamatti viewed a baseball game as a contest of virtue and hated cheating in any form. When the rules of baseball are broken, he wrote, the contest cannot in its essence exist. He claimed that his charge is to preserve the integrity of the game. In that vein, he lobbied to get rid of the designated hitter rule, which he thought compromised the glory of baseball. In 1989, Pete Rose, managing the Cincinnati Reds, was accused of betting on baseball games, including his own. As commissioner, Giamatti investigated the charges, eventually leading to Pete Rose being banned from baseball for life, a controversial arrangement to this day. In the wake of the scandal, Giamatti wrote about Pete Rose, no individual is superior to the game, but maintaining the integrity and beauty of the garden may have been too much for him. 9 days after the Pete Rose ban, Bart Giamatti suffered a fatal heart attack. He was 51. I gotta go.
Thank you, Ian Scholes. We could use somebody like Giamatti at the helm today.
Well, that's certainly true. We're talking with an authority on the philosophy of baseball. That's our colleague and friend, Alan Wood of Stanford University.
Alan, Bart Giamatti was willing to go out on a limb there and say that Dante would have been a baseball fan. Can you think of any of the great philosophers who would have been likely to be fans or not?
Yeah, that's a hard one.
I'll give you an easier one if you don't want to answer that one. I mean, you know, Giamatti was talking about preserving the integrity of the game. We haven't really talked about this issue. Some people worry deeply that the integrity of the game's being affected by the player's use of, you know, performance-enhancing substances. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, steroids,
well,
for example,
I think as a matter of public policy, it's very dangerous for the game that a lot of players are using these substances because it can encourage young people to do things that are very abusive to their bodies, and it calls the integrity of the game into question in the minds of many people. But it's a difficult question because it's hard to say exactly why players should be forbidden to use substances to enhance their performance and which substances are not supposed to be permitted and which are.
There was one performance enhancing substance that seems to me that they should use. I mean, it was a long, when I was playing baseball, they said, don't lift weights, don't work out, don't bulk up. That'll just ruin your swing. Mm-hmm. And these guys have gotten huge and muscular and solid. And Babe Ruth just went out, I think, and sort of partied up and then went and
beer and hot dogs.
Yeah.
That was his diet.
So, I mean, what's the difference between, you know, working out and bulking up in that way and these performance-enhancing substances? Which of them should be banned? Which shouldn't? I think that's a tricky question.
Mm-hmm. Well, probably the ones that are dangerous for people's health, no matter what good they do, should be banned, either legally or in terms of the policies of the league. However, I think you make a very good point, Ken. our own Barry Bonds says he doesn't take performance-enhancing stuff, that he shouldn't, and I'm willing to take him at his word. What he does do is clearly lift weights, and he has a physique that was just unknown in baseball, as do Sammy Sosa and the others back in Babe Ruth's day. I think if Mantle and Maris and Ruth had lifted weights, they would have hit more home runs.
Should we put an asterisk by Bonds' record?
No, absolutely not. Any more than we should have put one by Babe Ruth, because home run Baker didn't have the lively ball to hit over the fence.
Right, right. Do you have a view about any of this, Alan?
Yeah. Well, I think that it would be impossible to say how much even lifting weights, much less using any sort of substances, would contribute to home run records like Bonds or Mark McGwire. There's no way to measure that.
Yeah, there's a caller in the line, John in Sonoma. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Hello, guys.
Hello. What's your question?
It's baseball and unrequited love, and I'm a longtime San Francisco Giants fan, and every fall the Giants break my heart.
Yeah.
And every spring I seem to fall in love again, and in the real world I might not do this, but in the world of baseball it seems to happen over and over again. And so the question is, why do I go back when I know, you know, why do I give them my emotional interest and investments when I know there's a good chance it will not be returned?
That's an excellent question.
Let me point out that you're not the unluckiest of fans. There's the St. Louis Browns fans and the Kansas City Athletic fans and ones that don't have anybody to go back to.
Yeah, or the Cleveland Indian fans, or the Boston Red Sox fans,
or the Cubs fans.
So there's lots of that in baseball.
Well, I'm very sympathetic.
Why do we keep doing it, Alan?
I'm very sympathetic with the caller, and I think he's gotten into something that makes you a real baseball fan. If you're a fan of a team just because it wins, as many Yankees fans seem to be, that seems to me to make no sense. I mean, they don't need you, and you don't need them. It's a team like the Red Sox or the Giants or the Cubs that needs fans and that attracts your loyalty.
So let's end. Here's a comment from Eugene in Daly City that came in over the web. Let's see if we can get one more fan for some team. I often criticize popular media and the seemingly mindless entertainment they propagate, Eugene says, but I can't help but think that sports is very similar, something like the Roman gladiator games used to appease the masses. Help me get over this complex.
Oh, man, I can help you get over that. Baseball, I don't know about all sports, but baseball is a thing of beauty, where human excellence is constantly on display, where, you know, it's intensely dramatic. I mean, there's a reason it arouses passion in, you know, smart, articulate people and not so smart, not so articulate people, all people, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. You could use the same argument against a lot of art forms.
Like opera? You think opera was
Sure, that seems to be a particularly vulnerable one with
yeah,
the
right.
kind of lugubrious plots they often involve or fantastic things that happen in operas. They're much more distractions from reality than baseball is in many ways.
Well, we'll see if that goes over well with our intellectual friends at Stanford.
Yeah, right. Well, we've been talking about baseball with Professor Alan Wood of Stanford University. Alan, it's been a real pleasure talking to you about this stuff rather than all that departmental chaos. Thank you very much for joining us on Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
And thank you, Alan. It's been fun. So, Ken, you've learned a lot about baseball, having grown up in an American League city. It's good for you to be exposed to the real thing, the National League game here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
I understand you've got you're taking your family to quite a few games this year.
Yeah, that's right, and Giants games. But we'll also go see the A's, you know, especially when the Indians are in town.
I see.
And I know Giamatti was trying to get rid of the designated hitter rule, but I still love the designated hitter rule. I love the contest between pitcher and hitter, and there's just more of that in the American League.
You think it's partly disappeared with the shrunken strike zone and the helmets that people wear now? They didn't wear those when I was a kid, and the fact that pitchers aren't allowed to throw spitballs and they're not allowed to throw at batters?
Yeah,
these debase the game and take away the central fear of violence that's at the heart
well,
of it?
I mean, that fear of violence. I mean, you stand up there in the box with a 98-mile-an-hour fastball barreling in at you, right, and then moving away just at the last second, you know, and the guy that doesn't bail out, I mean, that's a real hitter. The guy that doesn't bail out, who knows enough about that pitcher's movement of that pitcher's ball to know that it's going to move away at the last minute.
I tell you, Ken,
that still takes courage. That takes great courage.
I agree with you. Based on my own experience, you stand up there with a 45-mile-an-hour fastball, and you can be scared enough to wet your pants.
Yeah, no, my main point, John, about it is I really think that baseball you can tell I'm passionate about it. I think it rises almost to the level of an art form. We were talking about loyalty to teams. I think, and why that matters. And whether you know baseball is intrinsically good. I think baseball is intrinsically beautiful. And loyalty to intrinsically beautiful things is a darn good thing.
Well, I hope we see you at the ball game, and I hope at least when the pitcher isn't pitching and the batter's not batting, you talk philosophy with the person you took there.
Talking baseball, Klazuski, Campanella, talking baseball, the man and Bobby Feller, the scooter, the barber and the nuke, they knew them all from Boston to Dubuque, especially Willie, Mickey and the Duke.
John, I hear. God, what is that thunderous sound? Is that a stampede of buffalo?
No, Ken, that's conundruming. It's time for our weekly conundrum.
And what would that be?
A conundrum is some logical or ethical question that's puzzling a listener, and they call us to have us help or stumble around, at any rate, with the question.
Actually, we have a caller on the line now. Mary, you really called us. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mary.
Well, thank you for having me. I have been stumbling around.
What's your conundrum, Mary?
My conundrum is a matter of friendship and what kind of responsibilities I have as a friend, if any. I have a very good friend who for the last 12 years has been in what you might as well call a marriage, even though they were actually never married. You know, they own a house together, a man and a woman, and they've been very happy, no children. And recently I discovered quite by accident that he's had an affair the last 2 years with another person that I know professionally. So I'm in the middle of this triangle, and what I'm wondering is, do I have a responsibility to tell my friend that he's cheating on her, which will certainly hurt her, or should I let her find it out on her own, which may hurt her worse? Should I confront him and say, I know what you're doing, this is wrong, stop it? Should I call this other woman that I know slightly and say, this is not a good idea, or do I have any responsibility? Should I just let this all sort itself out?
Well, this is a mess, John. I need your avuncular wisdom here.
Well, I always like to have an initial position, and it seems to me here the initial position is to do nothing unless you have some good argument for doing something. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that.
Yeah, you probably are wrong about that. I mean,
but by and large, you don't have a responsibility to tell people everything you know. But sometimes you do have a responsibility. Obviously, if your friend was stepping out on the street and a truck was coming, you'd have a responsibility to tell her. Friendship requires that you help her avoid a disaster by warning her about something. That would depend on what's going to happen if you don't tell her.
Well, I don't think I think of it in these terms. What am I obligated to do? I mean, you could ask that question, but it seems to me the question is, what can I do? That is to say, I would be tempted to say, you know what, your husband is an utter cad. I have to say, that would be my temptation. Now, the question I'd have to ask myself, Mary, is it all right for me to do that? I mean, is it all right for me to stick my nose there? Not am I obligated to do it, but is it all right? I mean, is there something you want to do? Is there something your heart says, do this, and you hesitate?
Well, this is about where I've been stumbling around. This is what feels right to me, is that if I feel she needs to know this, which I rather do, actually, but I'm not obligated to, should I feel that perhaps she's better off in ignorant bliss.
Why don't you talk to the transgressor? I mean,
that may be my best choice. Unfortunately, we do work together professionally, and that's going to be
things. You and the husband work together professionally.
Yes.
Maybe you might pull Joe aside and say, Joe, I'm really disturbed. I saw something that makes me believe. And Joe might get really mad at you and say, mind your own business and go, you know, fly a kite or something like that, or something stronger. But at least he will know that the jig is up, and then he'll have to confront his own kind of crisis, you know.
Yeah. Right, or make a decision in any case.
Right.
I like that option. I think that's the best one.
I hope we've helped you think about this just at least a little bit. Well, I don't pretend we've solved
it. It's always good to have somebody to stumble around in the dark with.
Well, it does help, and you've actually clarified my thinking, although there still seems to be no absolute path here. On the other hand, at least I feel that my course of action has been somewhat vindicated.
Thanks a lot, Mary.
Thanks, Mary. It's been nice talking to you.
Well, thank you. It has been nice talking to you.
To tell or not to tell can be a very difficult question.
Yes, and the answer isn't often clear in every situation. The one certainty is that you can always ask us for help with your conundrum. You can reach us at conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
Don't forget to let us know how we can reach you so you can join us on the program. Once again, that's conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2004.
Executive producer, Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University, or of our funders, or of any fictional baseball player.
Although in the case of my views, probably they should.
Yeah, right.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
You really are. And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you so much for listening.
And thank you for thinking, and thank you for supporting our local San Francisco Giants.